It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. As the month of April, Financial Planning Month, draws to a close, we're taking a look at what's been done to strengthen our financial systems for consumers, the markets, and regulators since 2008. Paul Brom is chairman and CEO of BPU Investment Management Incorporated, as well as a certified financial planner practitioner and an accredited investment fiduciary analyst. As a member of the board of directors for the Greater Pittsburgh Financial Planning Association, he joins us now to break down the world of personal finance post the Great Recession. Paul Brom, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. How are you?
I'm doing great, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with an overview of the financial crisis of 2007-2008. What happened? Why did it happen? Who was affected? And how did it affect us?
Sure. Well, essentially, the flow of money went to about zero. And that occurred because at the corporate level, at the personal level, we were completely over-leveraged. We borrowed way too much money. Chairman Greenspan of the Federal Reserve had decided that it was a good idea to raise money for lending in the banking sector through the issuance of bonds, so that the risk to any individual lender like a bank would be dispersed across many individuals, across many bondholders. And so each bondholder would have a little bit of risk across many people. So we started making bets on that, and banks decided they didn't have to manage risk so much, and they lent to people maybe they shouldn't have, and that practice of predatory lending really showed its ugly head.
So was the government's response effective, in your opinion?
I believe that it was. When the crisis came, John Maynard Keynes said we should do three things. We should cut taxes, cut interest rates, and deficit spend. And I think there's no one in the United States that would argue that the government hasn't deficit spent. And what they did through the TARP program, through quantitative easing at the Federal Reserve, they put a floor under a falling economy so that there could be stability and the private sector could eventually take over that economy again. And we're in that phase right now as the government slows and even withdraws some of that stimulus.
There was something that I'm sure you're familiar with, and probably many of our listeners as well, a piece of legislation that came into being after during the Great Depression, the Glass-Steagall Act.
Oh, sure.
And that went away for a while.
It did.
Then we had something similar to the Depression happen again. How much is that tied together?
Well, I think it's the the same gift, different wrapping paper. So what essentially happened is investment banking and retail or commercial banking were allowed to play under the same roof, so that a bank could issue a bond to raise money to loan it to other people rather than basing those loans on deposits like our savings accounts and CDs. And what that did was expand the lending power of the banking system. So when we had the collapse in the Great Depression, Glass-Steagall Act came as part of the legislative reform that occurred that separated investment banks from commercial banks. And we had a fairly stable financial or credit system, I'm going to say, after the introduction of Glass-Steagall all the way up until the decade beginning in 2000. Now, I think, and this is not a political statement, but President Clinton is quoted as saying, "I think we've learned a lot since the Great Depression, and we won't make that same mistake again." And a Republican Congress and President Clinton got rid of Glass-Steagall. 6 years later, we made exactly the same mistake, and we were in the same mess. So enter Dodd-Frank, essentially the reincarnation on a more sophisticated level of Glass-Steagall.
And exactly what has changed now since Dodd-Frank and the things that have been put in place since 2008, now roughly 6 years later?
Well, a lot of things have changed. As a result of Dodd-Frank, the capital requirements of banks have increased dramatically. Banks have had to go through initial stress tests and ongoing stress tests. And so the banking system is certainly shored up. And the TARP program helped that immensely by injecting capital into both banks and into private corporations like General Motors. That helped stem the notion of rampant unemployment because people kept their jobs and banks didn't collapse and people didn't lose money. And that was good, so there was stability there. On a regulatory front at another level, Dodd-Frank authorized the SEC to examine the fiduciary standard versus the suitability standard and authorized the SEC to raise suitability to fiduciary.
So, and just for people that might be scratching their heads a little bit, let's explain both of those things. First of all, what is a suitability standard?
And so in a nutshell, without making it a technical definition, if I'm functioning as a broker at a brokerage firm and I talk to you about purchasing a security, that security has to be appropriate for you based on your financial circumstances at that moment in time. And up until July of 2011, there was no real requirement to examine suitability on an ongoing basis. So if your circumstances changed or if the world changed around you, there was no duty for a broker to examine those holdings in light of those changes and redetermine suitability. And so what we found was people maybe took more risk than they should leading up to the financial crisis, and they weren't necessarily plugged into that level of risk. In July 2011, FINRA, the regulatory body for brokerage firms, changed that suitability standard and said it has to be reviewed on an ongoing basis. And even if you say to somebody, I think you should keep that security, FINRA has deemed that a hold recommendation, and you have to provide evidence why it's still appropriate to hold. And so from a regulatory perspective, FINRA has tried to increase the monitoring requirement on portfolios. On a fiduciary standard?
Yeah, I was going to say, what is a fiduciary standard?
On a fiduciary standard, it's what we call a best interest standard. So the advisor is registered different than a broker. They're registered as an investment advisor or an investment advisor representative, and they're held to a higher standard than suitability. Essentially, the advisor has to subordinate their own interests or the interests of their firm to the best interests of that client. Which then requires what? In theory, it requires very careful ongoing monitoring and a very careful line of communication between the client and the advisor to make sure everything works correctly.
We're talking with Paul Brahm, Chairman and CEO of BPU Investment Management Incorporated. He's a certified financial planner practitioner. Time for a couple more questions, Paul.
Sure.
And what is the difference between a broker under the suitability standard an investment advisor, representative, or certified financial planner under the fiduciary standard?
Sure. And I'm going to make these comments in all deference to my colleagues who work as brokers. I think most brokers in this country are very deeply concerned for their clients. From a legal perspective, however, their duty is to the company that they work for to generate revenue and profit. And that's been ruled in, I want to say, the Ninth Circuit Court probably 10 or 15 years ago. So their fiduciary duty is to their corporation, not to their customer. Now, a conscientious and competent broker will take on the mantle without the legal requirement of behaving in the best interests of the client, doing what's best for them because they'll keep them as a client for a long time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the difference is if I'm an investment advisor representative under the Investment Advisor Act of 1940, I am required by law to act in the best interest of that customer even if it's not in the best interest of my company. And certified financial planners through the ethics requirements have a similar duty to do what is in the best interest of their clients at the time. And so there's a bit of a difference in a legal standard, simply a higher sense of responsibility.
And last but not least, we have about 30 seconds or so. Are there any resources people can use to vet their advisor? And what would they be?
All right. And so you can go to the Financial Planning Association's website, fpa.net, and there's a Find a Planner function that will identify a certified financial planner or a number of them in your area. There's a list of about 33 questions that that someone should ask an advisor to understand what they function as. Are you functioning as a fiduciary or a suitability standard? What are your qualifications? And then, of course, you can look at regulatory records of advisors at FINRA's broker check. And so you go to FINRA.org and search for broker check, and you can find the entire regulatory education and licensing history of any licensed advisor.
Paul Brahm has been our guest. He's chairman and CEO of BPU Investment Management Incorporated and a certified financial planner practitioner. Joining us in Studio A, Paul, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing information with us here on the program.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh. Tomorrow, a preview of the Pittsburgh Marathon. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.